It's the Free Thinking President edition of Radio Free Thinker. This week, a hot march, testing climate change, more video game violence, Saskatoon exorcism, and an interview with the new president of the UBC Free Thinkers Club. Now let's begin episode 162.
It's time for Radio Free Thinker, the show that applies skepticism and critical thinking to everyday issues. The place where reason and reality cross swords with politics, religion, economics, and of course, science. Now let's get ready to be skeptical. The
cosmos is also within us. We're made of sparks. We are away. The cosmos can know itself.
Across the sea of space, the stars are others. We've traveled this way before, and there is much to be learned.
Hello and welcome to Radio Free Thinker, the radio show podcast that promotes skepticism and critical thinking, right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. My name is Ethan, your free thinking historian.
And this is Don, your political science philosopher. So Ethan, you know, we really appreciate getting feedback from our listeners. Equally, we appreciate the feedback from our blog. However, occasionally, not all of it is praise or acknowledgement of our greatness, although we are great.
That is true.
We received a comment recently from one person who took a bit of umbrage with one of the images on our last episode's show notes. The episode related to budget cuts and food inspection. And as it turned out, the actual particular graphic image that was used comes from an artist and a website called Counterthink, which promotes a lot of woo out there and what I would consider to be bad thinking regarding, a lot of topics, food, health, the economy, the whole nine yards. Now, I think that you know, I like using a lot of images. I think it's part of my style, and you may or may not like it. And we do some things on sort of time constraints. So sometimes we get rushed in trying to get it out there. And I must admit, looking back at this particular image, it was a bad image to use. Not so much that I think the image was bad in the context of it, but because it did make reference to the particular artist and website that it came from, that did sort of indirectly seem like we were promoting that site, and that was kind of a bad thing. Normally, when I put images up there, they tend to kind of fall in four categories. You know, there's sort of the directly educational. So those are the images, that are graphs or a diagram or something that is educational and related to the article. Sometimes they'll put on candy images, things that are sort of related, but not really, and they're just there to make it pretty or what have you. Sometimes they'll put on ones that I think are sort of explanatory humor. So they're meant to be funny, but they're also meant to make you think. Quite often I'll put up something about, the police state and the G20, and it's sort of designed to make you think. And occasionally I'll put up the ironic or mocking one. So this is one that's definitely promoting the woo side, but I think it is so over the top that I'm actually kind of making fun of them. Now, like I say, we have to be a bit careful in the images we use. We, of course, are not a prophet, so when I farm out the images, I don't spend a lot of time looking as to where they come from or that. I look at the cartoon, I say, or image, does this seem good? And I'll use it. But again, like I've been mentioning, skeptics have to be sometimes more vigilant than other people and making sure they get things right. Ethan?
Well, that's obviously true. But I mean, when you look at the way most people grab images from websites, they do a Google image search, and that doesn't often show the context of the website that it's taken from. I mean, you can get some pretty random results with that. So, I mean, while I agree it is important, of course, to examine sort of the origin of these pictures, especially if they're, copyrighted pictures. But at the same time, I mean, like what else could we, be upset with? I mean, if you used a picture of a UFO that came from a pro-UFO website, is that going to be a problem as well? I think that we may, be making a bit of a mountain out of a molehill when it comes to this.
I think one of the things, and something I will try and keep in mind in the future, is again, because I don't want to, I'm not really trying to steal these images. So if there is sort of identifiers for it, or if there's like, this is belongs to so-and-so, maybe follow up where the so-and-so is. Like I say, in big letters, this said Counterthink. Counterthink has a website. So it did seem to be a bit more than just having your Herman kind of cartoon or your random Joe Smith. But you're right. You know, I mean, we have to be careful that we don't go overboard in these sort of things.
Right. And I mean, that's sort of an important lesson to be had. I mean, after all, there's so many, you know, linking and referencing and things going on when it comes to blogs and online sources. I mean, sometimes, you know, if you link to a website that's promoting Woo or whatnot, you can actually drive up that website's Google relevancy. So, I mean, to a certain extent, it's part of the nature of the internet that these things are going to happen. I mean, it's very hard to control for all these different factors. So, I mean, like you said, we'll be vigilant, but at the same time, our hands are tied to a certain extent with this sort of thing.
Exactly, exactly. Speaking of being vigilant, have you been watching the weather lately, Ethan?
Watching the weather?
Well,
I watch the Weather Network sometimes.
I don't know if you've been noticing, but it's been actually quite a nice spring. In fact, I think this has been one of the warmest winters we've had here in Vancouver in a long time.
Yes, it is.
Good. I have your expert opinion on that. Well, it seems that NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Agency of the U.S., agrees that it has been quite nice. It recently published that in March, more than 1,500 temperature records were broken, as in warmest temperature. That March itself is the second warmest in recorded history. Well, recorded history as in how long NOAA has been keeping statistics, and that's been up to 1895, or at least in eastern and central U.S. It was actually kind of cooler in the West Coast. Why, you may ask? Well, global warming refers to the entire globe. However, climate change induced by warming will take many different forms. So most places will get warmer, but some places will actually get colder due to the changes in things like rainfall, wind currents. So as the globe warms, the equatorial or trade winds increase. However, for North America, when they hit something like the Rockies, they're actually deflected to the north. This creates sort of two large gyruses that circle in the Atlantic and in the Pacific. Everything east of the Rockies gets gusts of warm air from the Gulf region. So as the energy increases in the atmosphere because of the warming, those currents become stronger and more regular, thus warm temperatures. And the west, however, gets its winds largely from the north. So actually, we should be getting a little cooler than average. But again, I still think it's been kind of warm. It's interesting to note, in the last decade, of the top 5 years for the most number of tornadoes, and you may not have heard this, but recently in the United States, they had one of the most unprecedented warnings about tornadoes, as in severity and danger and risk, because that's becoming a much larger issue, apparently, in the United States. And actually, of the top 5 years, including a super outbreak, which occurred last year, where over 400 tornadoes happened in one day, these occurred all in the last decade. This year alone has been a doozy as well, with 165 tornadoes already, compared to the average of the last 5 years of about 125 years, which just shows that, you know, climate change deniers are out there, but the evidence is just overwhelmingly growing against them.
Well, for sure. I mean, just watching sort of the news on the latest tornado outbreaks in the U.S., I mean, it's quite shocking when you really think about it. I mean, of course, they do get more tornadoes than, you know, say the Vancouver area does. But even just mentioning sort of the local weather that we've been having, I mean, it's been a really kind of strange winter for us. Perhaps wetter than usual, but also not nearly as cold as we might expect, I think. That being said, it's been a very mild spring as well. So, I mean, we're sort of experiencing a bit of strange trends here in our sort of local weather patterns.
And I think actually strange is probably the best word to use in this. Because again, the term global warming has been kind of passe to use, because it implies that every place is going to get warm, when in actual fact, the globe in general gets warmer, but it really means climate change, as in what we've been used to, what seems to have been the norm, is altered and changing. So places that were once wet areas are going to become drier. Places that were drier may become wetter. And there's going to be this more extremeness to the climate change.
Well, for sure. I mean, and the difficult aspect, of course, is going to be measuring how those some cases it might seem like minor changes are going to impact the environment and the ecosystem, perhaps in some really drastic ways. I mean, one thing that we hear a lot of in BC is this sort of pine beetle infestation in sort of the interior. And in order to sort of kill off this sort of parasitic bug, we need really, really cold winters. But we haven't been getting really, really cold winters. And it's caused our forests to get really dry. So in the summer, when we have warmer and warmer summers, that creates the perfect kindling for large forest fires, which have, you know, devastated the interior recently in the last couple of years. So, I mean, even like a minor change in temperature, it might mean like you get an extra day at the beach perhaps, but it can also wreak havoc with a lot of the other systems that we have in place. Like, we're not really adapted to a system that is brand new in BC. We're adapted to sort of the traditional kind of, you know, somewhat cold but not too cold winters and, you know, the somewhat warm but not that warm summers. So when we start to mess around with that, we're going to have to anticipate some major changes to how we deal with, you know, the fallout of these sort of strange behaviors.
You know, and that also plays into to an interesting aspect as well that a lot of people overlook, is they often look at the peaks, you know, the highest and the lowest. And because climate is always quite variable, you know, you may look back in the history records and find days that were hotter 100 years ago, not as often, but they were hotter. But where it really has its huge impact is that the average, the median temperature changes. And ironically enough, the farther away from the equator you go, the greater those changes get. So at the equator, they're expecting to have a change of roughly like half a degree. But when you go up into the Arctic Circle, that equates roughly to closer to 3 or 4 degrees increase in temperature. Again, not the super hot days or the super cold days, just the average energy in the system. And you get things, like you say, you know, a more hospitable climate for pine beetles to live. The melting of glaciers. I mean, glaciers themselves don't live on the coldest day. They live all year round. And the fact that we're having an unprecedented retreat in glaciers just reinforces that. In fact, when we come back from this commercial, we're going to take an actual sort of a skeptical test of the climate change model by looking at a paper published in 1981 and its predictions and see how far we've come after this break.
I'm excited about that.
Woo-hoo! And we're back.
The federal government is trying to ram through a set of electronic surveillance laws that will invade your privacy and cost you money. The plan is to force every phone and internet provider to surrender our personal information to authorities without a warrant. The worst part of their invasive, all-encompassing surveillance scheme is that you have to pay for it out of your own pocket. Send Ottawa a message by signing the petition at stopspying.ca. That's www.stopspying.ca. Thank you.
Hello, this is Tony Sobrado, social scientist and theorist on conspiracy theories. You are listening to Radio Freethinker on CITR Radio 101.9 FM in Vancouver, British Columbia. You can also listen to the show by subscribing to iTunes. And I hope you enjoy your skeptical discussions and debate.
And we're back. So, climate change, then and now. In a paper published in 1981 in Science by the now controversial James Hansen at NASA's Institute for Space Studies at Goddard Space Flight Center, Hansen is controversial because of his activism and persistent activities against climate change. In particular, promoting carbon tax, his call for the arrest of fossil fuel company executives, and for stating that man-made climate change was, quote, a moral issue on par with slavery. Ethan, do you think it's a issue on par with slavery?
There's not too much on par with slavery. I'll just say that.
True. Although its impact in parts of the world are much more greater than those on us rich industrial societies. In the paper that was published by Hansen et al., laid out a model for global warming, the mechanisms, and made some interesting predictions. So I thought it would be good for us to sort of see the predictions that were made and how they've turned out. As our listener knows, one of the fundamental aspects of scientific skepticism is to test such predictions of a theory to see if they have validity, at least superficially. In the 1981 paper, they had historical data about CO2 concentrations. At the time, they showed a rise from about 280 parts per million in 1880 to 335 parts per million in 1980. They had temperature data over a similar period. They then projected into the future based on a high or a no-growth carbon input and projected the growth or the increase in the average global temperatures. He predicted an increase in temperatures by 2010 between roughly 0.5 to 0.3 degrees, as well as an atmospheric concentration of CO2 of about 396. Now, to be fair, the 396 number was my extrapolation from his graph. But as it turns out, he seemed to have been kind of optimistic. The current global mean temperature has increased by 1.4 degrees, and currently we have a CO2 concentration of 395 parts per million and growing. So it seems like the scientific data seems to have been there. But they went a little further than that, as they actually made some more predictions about what these numbers would actually mean to the planet. So they also predicted a decrease in the precipitation in areas like the southern United States, which is currently undergoing unprecedented drought, and areas like Australia. The deterioration of the Western Antarctic ice shelf, which, again, if you read the news or you check out your science blog post, you'll see that significant parts of the Ross ice shelf has disappeared and gone off into the sunset. And the opening of the Northwest Passage, which again points to another sort of irony that not all aspects of climate change are necessarily going to be bad for us. For Canada, we're going to come out as big winners in some ways because a lot of area in our sort of northern land will actually become arable, livable, and with the Northwest Passage, we can become a major trading hub, eliminating things like the Panama Canal.
Yay! Well, I mean, like, that's not the best trade-off, I don't think, for Canada. I mean, it's actually kind of interesting that they were pretty accurate with their predictions. I mean, fairly close on the CO2 levels, and I mean, they were off a little bit by the warming. But again, like, the problem with predicting global temperature is that it's very difficult, and so many different things are going to impact temperature. I mean, the fact that they even came that close is, I guess, kind of remarkable in some regards, because, like, you know, any little thing that could happen can offshoot this sort of delicate process of figuring it out. I mean, people are always saying how the model for predicting weather is pretty crummy. I mean, how many times do you turn on the news and get a bad prediction on what it's going to be in the next 4 hours? So for them to be able to do this on a global scale is pretty impressive.
Yes, actually. And, you know, it's quite interesting to note that, I mean, firstly, Hansen studied the atmosphere of Venus, which is largely responsible for his approach to Earth climate and why he became such an exponent of climate change and greenhouse gases and how you can get a runoff effect of that. But it's sort of a great example of why space exploration is not wasted science. It's not like pie in the sky sort of thing, that it actually has very important value in many ways and often unexpected ways right here on Earth. It's also interesting that when he published this paper in the 80s, early 80s, it wasn't actually a hot spot in the century. In fact, at that time, the 1940s was sort of a hot spot. So the degree of confidence that they had to have in their research was quite strong. I mean, they were going against the sort of current consensus of what was going on. And Hansen knew, and society in one way or another will learn, that, you know, if you have the evidence on your side, if you're sure about your science and you've done your data, you've done your research well, that the scientific community will follow you, because that's one of the beauties of science, is its self-correcting mechanism.
Being able to point at Venus as a perfect example of what was happening was, I mean, a really important key in understanding climate change. And of course, for making these kind of predictions. I mean, I remember seeing clips of Carl Sagan on Ted Turner's newscast talking about global climate change and talking specifically about Venus. And it was a real amazing proof of concept for the whole, you know, idea and the theory and everything.
No, exactly. And, you know, like I say, I love this particular bit of research. In fact, it's so bizarre how this paper had been uncovered, because most people had forgotten about it. I guess Hansen himself had forgotten about it. But apparently a sort of climate type scientist had got ill and he was bored. So he kind of flipped through some old magazines and happened to uncover this particular research. And whammo, you're able to do one of the most important aspects of science, is to test a prediction and see how accurately it lives up to that. And again, it seems like, again, another win for these people who deny climate change. It's so sad that they're out there. And it's so sad that people who are most vehemently against climate change are the biggest leaders of the world. It's like our national leaders are about it. And it's sad. Mitt Romney, who may become the president of the United States, not likely, but possibly, doesn't believe that there's man-made climate change. And that has such a sad and scary aspect for our future.
Yeah, absolutely. But let's shift gears a little bit here on the show. We're going to go from climate change to video game violence. So I guess two potentially depressing topics. But this is kind of a bit of a follow-up. We talked about video game violence a few months ago back on the show. And some interesting studies have come out in the meantime that we can take a look at here. So, of course, to summarize the debate, there's this question about whether or not people playing violent video games is going to affect their behavior. Meaning, if a normally mild-mannered person plays a video game that includes lots of violence and aggressive behavior, is that person then going to become more violent, more aggressive, or become desensitized to seeing violence and aggressive behavior in society? Well, a group of researchers in Sweden are suggesting that that's the wrong question to ask. So, out of the University of Gothenburg in Sweden, some scientists decided to study the behavior of people who regularly play violent video games. And what they discovered was kind of interesting. People who play violent video games, whether they're playing them against each other, or whether they're playing them as sort of cooperative online games, they do share some common traits. But one of them appears to be the ability to cooperate and work together. So this would actually suggest that overly aggressive people who have trouble interacting with other people in a, you know, nice and polite way are actually worse off at playing violent online video games. And sure enough, that's what the research has shown. So imagine you have two different people. One of them is really angry, really violent, really unpredictable. One person is more thoughtful, careful, better able to interact with people. Which one of these two people is going to have better luck in a simulation that requires long-term strategic planning and cooperation amongst individuals? Predictably, it's the person who is sort of not a total jerk. And what the gaming situations have shown here is that the total jerks, like people who get really aggressive and say nasty, mean things over like Skype and that kind of thing, they're not very good at playing video games. And it turns out the people that are really good at playing video games, even the really violent ones like Call of Duty and that kind of stuff, don't demonstrate this kind of erratic, aggressive behavior. So then what is going on here? Does this mean that video games, in fact, don't encourage violence, but actually encourage cooperation? Well, that might be going a bit too far with this particular study. But what it's pretty clearly saying here, though, is that overly aggressive people are not going to get very far out of playing video games. They're not going to find it a very satisfying experience, which I guess you could say is talking a bit about the chicken and the egg thing here. Because are we assuming that video games makes people aggressive, or that aggressive people like to play violent video games? Well, this study kind of indicates that actually violent, aggressive people won't enjoy playing violent, aggressive video games because they're going to suck at them. And that people who are more level-headed will enjoy those games because being level-headed allows them to, you know, progress through the game and have a good time. So very interesting research on this, and I think lends a lot of credence to the idea here that video games, their effect on the way that we behave has been, I think, kind of poorly studied, and perhaps, like they said, asking the wrong questions here. The question may not be, do games make you violent, but rather, you know, how do games impact your ability to interact with people? And then, you know, you ask the question is, well, who are the people here who are interacting? And in this case, we have two ideas here. We have the sort of violent person and the calm person. And I don't know. It seems to make a lot of sense to me. What do you think?
Well, you know, it's funny because game playing in general has kind of gone through this interesting circular movement. I mean, you go back, you know, 50, whatever years ago, where all game playing was sort of a social activity. And you had to be sort of friendly and sociable in order to play them because you literally had to play them with other people. Then we kind of evolved into the early parts of sort of the video game, where actually video games were largely antisocial in the sense that, you know, you played them individually. As long as you were willing to sort of put in the time and you had the patience, and I think a violent person can be patient, you know, you could have this, well, maybe it does reflect a violent personality, but now video games have kind of gone full circle, and so many of them are online and interconnected, and they've become social again. And again, it seems even in the violent sort of video games, you can't be an antisocial sort of individual because you can't really play these games as they were intended to play. So in that sense, I think you're kind of right on with the idea that maybe it's not so much that the study of violence in video games is wrong, but it can easily become misdirected depending on the sort of area that they're sort of covering. Again, there's been such a huge evolution of the whole gaming genre over the last three generations of people.
Yeah, and I think that was something that we kind of touched on when we last talked about video game violence and the supposed connection between violent behavior and violent video games. It was just, well, how well are we documenting this connection, this supposed connection that exists? Because there's so many different kinds of video games and there's so many different kinds of people who play video games. I mean, take like a board game, for instance. Now, if someone's playing an aggressive board game, I'm going to use Monopoly as an example because I actually think it is kind of an aggressive video board game.
Capitalist too, very bad.
Well, not just that, but I mean, it's pretty cutthroat. Versus a game that perhaps encourages a bit more cooperation, that's maybe less adversarial.
Now, just for reference, when you play the Monopoly, right? I mean, maybe your parents were evil. You know it's not real money you're playing with. Or do you actually play Monopoly with real cash?
Sometimes I do. But the point being is that the question we shouldn't necessarily be asking is, does, say, Monopoly encourage aggressive, violent behavior? But who are the people that are going to enjoy Monopoly? And if it's the sort of violent, aggressive, sort of random people who do enjoy Monopoly, well, that might say something about the game Monopoly. But what research is sort of pointing at is that those kind of people don't really enjoy those kind of games. They may get really violent and aggressive during the game, but they don't tend to win the game. And I think that's like, I mean, maybe it's just sort of anecdotal evidence, but from what I recall about playing games and board games, video games, whatever, is that the person who like loses their temper and starts to like scream and yell and throw over the game, that person doesn't seem to win very often.
Well, quite often, the reason why they're yelling and screaming is because they're losing. And you're right, there's sort of a negative feedback loop involved in that. I also think, too, I think the only area where they may have a certain degree of, there is a link to this and violence, is the idea of the sort of Pavlovian, you know, stimulus and reward. So I know it's simulated violence, right? Usually in video games. And when you play with other people, if you sit there and you see you made someone cry because you took their last property or they landed on Boardwalk, you know, and you got that sort of thrill, woohoo, I've sort of won. And that gets associated with the act, which I think is really the foundation of all of video games lead to violence sort of research. I mean, there is a certain amount of validity in that, but that ignores the whole other aspect of what's going on is, again, games are innately, at least in the current versions, are innately social. I mean, right now, everyone at work is playing that Pictionary sort of game, right? You draw something and can you guess what it is? And again, how can you be sort of violent and antisocial in that? If nothing else, people just won't play with you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been playing that game a lot. And you know, if you get somebody who doesn't sort of follow the rules, it's just like, well, then that person's not going to keep playing because, you know, you're going to delete your game with that person and no one's going to want to keep playing with them. Whereas when you get somebody who cooperates and, you know, sort of follows the kind of rules, then you want to keep playing with them. It's actually, it could be a really good example of whole like game theory and everything like that, tit for tat kind of thing. Which, by the way, any listeners out there, my username on Draw Something is Flying Skeptic. Look me up. But anyway, it is a really good example of, you know, what happens to sort of rule breakers and betrayers in sort of like the virtual world. I mean, they tend to get kicked out, ostracized, and removed from the game. So, like I said, we can learn things from video games, folks.
We can. And speaking of misdirection, when we come back from this break, we're going to talk about exorcism in Saskatoon.
Ooh. Saskatoon, nice.
Want to know what's up at UBC? Read the UBC. It's only the largest student newspaper in Western Canada, and it's written and edited entirely by UBC students. The UBC is your source for on-campus news, culture, and sports. New editions come out every Monday and Thursday. For breaking news as well as amazing videos and blogs, check out ubc.ca.
This is Phil Plait of BadAstronomy.com, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM for UBC in Vancouver, British Columbia.
And we're back here on Radio Free Thinker. So let's shift gears once again, this time talk about our friends in Saskatchewan, where some strange things are happening.
Yes, Ethan. It seems like Saskatoon is moving back to the Dark Ages. Apparently, a priest had an altercation with what a rational person would describe as a mentally disturbed individual. However, the priest thinks he knows the real reason, the devil. The incident in question was prompted when a man's niece called the priest, saying her uncle was, quote, showing signs of possession. When the priest arrived, he found a man who had carved the words hell on his chest. When the priest approached, the man growled, he is mine, or in some spooky voice. The priest, not being completely stupid, called the police. While waiting for the police to show up, he blessed the man, saying, he belongs to the good side, to Jesus. Now, the man did seem to respond to this. According to the priest, however, when the police showed up, the man again became agitated. And I think the police showing up at my door would make me agitated. The priest, of course, instead of trying to console the man, just continually blessed the man. And eventually the man kind of calmed down and was taken away by the police. There is no mention in the report, and this was by the CBC, of the fate of this disturbed individual. The priest said he was not sure if the man was possessed or suffering a nervous breakdown. Well, I think I can answer that. It was a nervous breakdown or some similar mental illness.
Yeah. Being possessed by the devil, I mean, that doesn't happen very often, if ever.
That's so 15th century.
Yeah.
You know, it's funny, too. I mean, like I say, the priest did do the right thing. He called the cops. He called for someone authority because you come in, you see this. But someone's cutting themselves and acting weird. The niece should not have called the priest. The priest should have been the one who called the RCMP, called for an ambulance. It was definitely, this is one of the ways in which religious thinking can be so messed up and have real harms to individual. I mean, what if this priest was sort of, you know, one of the Pentecostals, was kind of one of the out there, and said, okay, this man is definitely possessed by the devil. We need to tie him down. We need to do the whole exorcist sort of thing. One, who knows what harm and damage they could have done to the individual. But two, it kind of equates to a form of torture on this poor guy who, again, is definitely seems to be suffering from some form of mental illness.
Yeah, I'm also curious, like, how old the niece was in this case.
That's true. And again, this was kind of a weird article on the CBC. Because the rest of the article goes on and it discussed the absence of any trained exorcist in Saskatoon. It kind of ends on a discussion of the nature of evil and how to respond to people who claim a possession.
Is that like a serious problem in Saskatoon, the lack of exorcists? I mean, does that come up in like the town hall meetings? You know, is that like a real like burden on the population of Saskatoon, the lack of exorcists?
Well, you know, it's one of those sort of interesting schizophrenias you get in the, and no offense because of what the guy may have been schizophrenic, but it's one of these interesting dichotomies you get in the religious community. Because one of the things, besides talking to this local bishop, who said that, yes, this is, at least in his circles, a big issue, and I think the nearest exorcist they have is in Calgary, and they've been trying to figure out if they should do something to sort of have this shared exorcist who could travel around. But they also had a quote from an Anglican priest who used to work with the last exorcist in Saskatoon, and he stated churches have to respond, and they'll either do it by saying, quote, well, it's the devil and the devil is at work in the world and we've got to deal with it, or the church will say, well, there's certainly evil in the world, whether this is actually Satan or the devil, well, there's certainly evil in the world and it has terrible effects in people's lives, you know, and so we've got to respond, quote, this is what he had said. And I think this is such a way of saying, you know, that the churches themselves are hitting that wall of reality, that they've got to acknowledge that their dogma in some way is defeated. And he's sort of desperately trying to maintain some rationality for this sort of craziness, that they're, in spite of the evidence, they have to find some context in which demon possession seems plausible, even if they no longer acknowledge that it's really demons, but it's evil in the world and it causes mental illness. So they, you know, acknowledging that maybe it's mental illness, but it's mental illness inspired by Satan or something.
I think that the CBC may have a fantastic premise for a new TV show, The Last Exorcist in Saskatoon. I'd watch that.
That would be so hilarious. Speaking of The Last Exorcist in Saskatoon, when we come back, we're going to come up with the latest president of the UBC Freethinkers.
Who may or may not be an exorcist. Stay tuned.
Despite the fact that 8 in 10 Canadians are against warrantless and costly online spying, the government remains stubborn, set to cement this scheme into law. With their huge PR budget, they've unleashed a reckless and irresponsible campaign that suggests warrantless collection of our private data is on par with a phone book. We can't let them trick Canadians. Go to www.openmedia.ca now to find out what you can do to get involved and stop this smoke and mirrors campaign the government has started.
Joining us now on Radio Freethinker is the new president of the UBC Freethinkers Campus Club, Stephanie Van Dyke. Welcome to the show, Stephanie.
Hi, Ethan. Nice to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. What is your background and how did you find yourself involved with the UBC Freethinkers?
So, as part of a Protestant evangelical community, quite conservative, and coming out of high school, coming to university, I found myself having some questions. One notable occasion, I was in a biology class in first year, and as I started to realize that there was no debate about creationism and evolution in my university, my mind was a little blown. And so as that happened, I really began to look for a place where I could find the same sorts of community I found in my church, minus the God. And so that's how I became involved in the UBC Freethinkers. I was looking for some friends, really.
Is this a recent transition from a religious background to a skeptic one?
Fairly recent. I'm in my fourth year now, and it was sort of over the process of first year that this happened. Fairly recent, yeah. I mean, I was always a sort of analytical thinking sort of person. It's just that when you are in a community that where everyone believes something so fundamental like God exists, those are things you don't think to question. And in a lot of ways, I was never really what you might call a good Christian. I asked a lot of uncomfortable questions, but it wasn't really till I got here that I was able to fully break free.
And talk a bit about that process of breaking free from religion. I mean, we've often discussed how it can be an incredible
burden on your social life, but your personal life as well, your family, your close friends who now see you as kind of a lost soul. So was that transition very difficult for you, or did you find your friends and family accepting of it?
It was extremely difficult, partially because it's something that I always took very seriously, and it's something I still do take seriously, that is my relationship to the universe. But what I found was that most of my friends were totally fine. And in fact, most of my high school friends, these kids that I went to this conservative high school with, had similar experiences coming out of their out of high school. And in a lot of ways, is none of them, very few of the people I went to high school with are still fully believing Christians, ranging more the spectrum from atheist, where I am, to, you know, a vague feeling of God in the universe. And so what we found is that actually, in a lot of cases, it made me closer with my friends. My family is a different issue. My family is very religious and will always be. But my father has this thing he says. He says, well, we're not raising sheep. And he's a Christian, and a very educated man. And I think he understands that I had to follow my own intellectual convictions.
Well, that's good to hear. So you mentioned you were very analytical. So were you kind of perhaps a lifelong skeptic, and then, you know, university life brought it out? Or what do you think was the motivating factor for it?
Well, I think when I first heard the term skeptic, I kind of didn't understand the point of the term, because I thought, well, doesn't everyone use their reason and rationality to determine the truth of things? But then I realized that wasn't really true. And thinking about it more deeply, I guess that is something that's maybe more unique about me. Growing up, I wouldn't necessarily say I was a lifelong skeptic. I would say that I about science. I'm very curious, and so maybe while I didn't ask all of the questions that I should at the time, I was always interested in learning new things. And then the skepticism is just sort of a new level of rigor brought to that process. I don't even know if I would call myself a skeptic now. I don't feel like I know enough. I haven't been involved in the movement long enough to call myself that. But it is something I feel very, very positively towards and you know, give me 2 years.
So then if you're feeling maybe uncomfortable with the term skeptic, how do you try to identify yourself as a, you know, in the generalized free thought movement? Is it free thinker, humanist, atheist? What term do you like to use?
I like to use the term atheist, I suppose. I think it best sums up everything someone might need to know, especially because I still do hang out with a lot of evangelical Christians, and they don't really understand what you might mean if you say, oh, I'm a free thinker. They get confused. But I think it's something that I feel very positively towards the whole secular movement, and as I've experienced sort of the diversity of thought out there, it's something I'm sure I'll settle on to perhaps a more fancy term as my life goes on.
Oh, that's good. So what are your key interests in the, you know, broader free thought movement? Are there any blogs, books, or ideas that you're particularly drawn to?
Well, even when I was an evangelical Christian, as a sort of pretentious 16-year-old, I would call myself a feminist. And that's something I feel very strongly about. I am a great admirer of people like Greta Christina, Rebecca Watson, and Jen McCrite. And I guess that sort of subgroup of the secular movement is one that I found that I feel very at home in. It's something that I really, there's a lot of people there I really enjoy meeting, and a lot of ideas I think that are really important.
And tell us a bit about your plans for the club this year. What sort of activities will the Freethinkers be getting up to?
Well, as you probably know, there's some big shoes to fill. Our former president, who is graduating, has been really involved in the club for a long time. And so part of me is just, you know, don't rock the boat too much. But one thing that I think is really important is that I want the club to continue to grow in the way it has over the last few years under our former president's leadership. And we've been doing a lot of really interesting events, And I'm really excited, as I've been talking to my exec and our new members about, you know, what sort of speakers do we want to bring in, what sort of lectures we want to bring in, and to continue our social events, which everyone really likes. One interesting thing we're doing right now is we're sending out a survey shortly to poll our members in a more perhaps rigorous way to say, which events did you like? Which ones don't you like? What do you want to see next year? And that will be going out to anyone who's on our mailing list or involved in our Facebook group shortly.
So do you guys think you'll be focusing more on humanism, atheism issues, or more on science-y skepticism issues?
That's an interesting question. I mean, in some sense, I think that's a hard distinction to make. But I suppose looking at the makeup of our exec team, actually, you know what? There's people from all sort of sides, parts of that spectrum there. I hope to walk that line carefully and to give our members what they want, which is to say events that intrigue them, speakers that challenge them, and things that are fun to do.
Excellent. And so based on your experiences at UBC, what do you feel are the pressing concerns for free thinkers there?
Well, UBC is, there's a lot of very atheistic people at UBC, and even the religious people are sort of quietly religious mostly. I think one of the big concerns is that there's a lot of pseudoscience in Vancouver generally, but also that sort of leaks into UBC in sort of strange ways. I remember having a conversation a few weeks ago in my computer science classes, smart people, and they were talking about how they couldn't believe this professor would just say all alternative medicine, if it works, is just because of the placebo effect. They were so shocked and horrified and offended because clearly that wasn't true. And I was shocked that this was what they were mad about. They were talking about, well, the one girl was a computer science biology student. She was so mad that people would talk about alternative medicine is not working. And I think that's one of the big issues that UBC faces in terms of skepticism generally, and just science education more specifically.
You mentioned the religious groups on campus. Many of them are quite well funded. They tend to have a lot of clout. How will this impact what you guys get up to on campus?
Well, you're right that the religious groups, if you go up against them, you're not just talking to other students. You're talking to other students plus the lots of money they get from their denomination. And you see this at our event, like clubs days or whatever, when all the clubs go out and put their tables out and talk to the first years. Because they're banned, there's a lot of people who are too old to be students milling around the booth. It's interesting to see how when we interact with them, it's hard because we have tried to reach out to them to maybe get some interfaithy stuff going or just to build good relationships with these clubs. And they always send you up the chain until the person they want who's talking to you has no real interest in what it means to be a student. And that's hard. On the other hand, we have a lot of support from the skeptical community and the secular community at large. Most large for adults, quote, organizations have a branch concerned with what the student groups are getting up with. CFI has their CFI on campus. There's the SSA. And so we do have some support. And I think it's good because I think that supporting student activities really just means supporting what you do in 3 years. But you're right. It is hard. You can't fight that dollar for dollar, or really, even if you try to fight it, you're going about it wrong because there's no way anyone could win or you would really want to win. That's not a campus I would want to live on anyway. I was very involved in a couple Christian groups in first year, and I still have friends there, though they treat me more suspiciously now.
Kind of leads to my next question. How vocal will the club be? Will you guys be pursuing a more sort of direct, hardline, secularist stance, or maybe more of a olive branch approach?
I think for me, when I look at the problems in the world personally, I'm more concerned with addressing the underlying causes of things. And for me, I view things like homophobia or sexism or racism or anti-scientific thinking as the root causes. And religion, for example, is just one way that that can manifest. But some of the most amazing feminists, for example, that I know are Christians. And so for me personally, I would advocate more of an olive branch, trying to find allies on specific issues. Because I think that even if you're talking about something like a Blasphemy Day project or something like that, there are religious people who are very concerned with these issues too. And you have a better chance of being successful in your activism if you have more support. And I think with a lot of people who support these issues, when explained to them clearly, or when they're just brought to their attention, even if they are part of a religious organization.
And what about the events and the activities that the Freethinkers get up to? Do you guys imagine yourself being more of an activist group or more of a social group?
I would hope to be maybe both, with an additional prong of an educational group. We've done by volume more social events than almost anything else, and then followed by education, simply because I think activist events are harder to organize and not always needed. You don't want to be an activist for the sake of being an activist. But it's something that I think I would want to be both, and I think is important that the UBC Freethinkers does do activism and is vocal about these issues, because we are the only secular group on campus. There's nobody else. And if we don't speak out, there's a skeptic group standing up to say something else or anything like that. So I would hope to be both. And it's one of my goals is to increase our activism. But of course, that depends on the willingness of my exec team and what the members actually want.
What do you anticipate being the biggest challenge to the club this year?
Well, it's the biggest challenge that happens to every club. I'm entering my final year at UBC, so regardless of what I do, I can't do this for more than 1 year. And one of my sort of personal goals is to make sure that when I leave the club, it's in a good state to continue. And this is always hard for campus groups, this continuity, because our leadership just leaves continuously, even if they don't want to. And it's been hard just these last few weeks as I've been, taking over for our previous president, who's involved for years and years. And, you know, there's questions you have to ask and things you have to talk about that she's just been able to assume that I have no idea. So that's one thing I want to work on, to make sure that the continuity of the club is solid. And I think one of our biggest challenges. Additionally, I think it's the same problem that all UBC clubs face, which is that because we're a commuter campus, it's hard to get people passionately involved in student life on campus. But, you know, you do your best. You use your social media and you try to do cool events, and usually it works out fairly okay.
Well, I mean, one of the benefits of being in Vancouver, a city with a pretty thriving free thought community, is that you have a lot of other groups to rely on, to get advice from, and lots of experienced skeptics and atheists out there.
Yeah, that's definitely true. And it's something I hope to capitalize on for sure.
So maybe for our last question, what are you most looking forward to for the club this year?
Oh, there's so many things I'm looking forward to. One thing that I'm really excited about is that we're hoping to get started more of like a weekly discussion group, which is something that I think a lot of campus groups all over North America do, but we've never really done. And we've had a lot of demand for it. And I think that's going to be really interesting. And I hope to create quite the little passionate community around that. And I'm also just really excited to continue working on this thing that I'm so passionate about. And that was, this club was really there for me when I needed it, when I was in second year and I was feeling very confused and kind of alone, I guess. in my world, my new world news. I guess that's probably what I'm most excited about.
Excellent. I mean, one of the great things about the club has always been its ability to connect people with a new network that allows them to not have to worry about what they don't believe in or what they do consider important. And that's one of the great things about the Freethinkers, and something that I remember was a really important thing when I was involved with the club. And so I'm really glad to see that that's going to continue. And of course, really glad to see that the club itself is continuing. As I'm sure you know, this isn't the first sort of free thought group that UBC has had, and sometimes they do kind of fizzle out. So it's pretty awesome to see that you guys have a good exec going this year, and I can't wait to see what kind of events you guys come up with.
Well, thank you. I'm really excited for it, and we'll keep you posted.
Absolutely. All right. Well, Stephanie, thank you for joining us on Radio Free Thinker, and please come on again in the future.
Oh, my pleasure.
Become a friend of CITR and get great discounts in the Main Street area at
Antisocial Skateboard Shop, Devil May Wear, Flaming Angels Boutique, Lucky's Comics, Neptune Records, Red Cat Records, The Regional Assembly of Text, RX Comics, Temple of the Modern Girl, and the Wallflower Modern Diner.
It pays to be a friend of CITR. To learn more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus or check us out online at citr.ca.
And we're back on Radio Freethinker. So our thanks to Stephanie, the new president of the UBC Freethinkers. If you want to get more information about the UBC Freethinkers, be sure to check them out on Facebook as well as their website. We'll have all the links on radiofreethinker.com in our show notes. Well, we're running out of time here on the show, so let's go to our skeptical highlights. And I got one here, and boy, is it interesting. Shoppers Drug Mart has been named in a $30 million lawsuit for selling homeopathic products. This lawsuit is brought together in part by the Center for Inquiry Canada and the Committee for the Advancement of Scientific Skepticism at CFI CAS. So the crux of this particular lawsuit is the fact that Shoppers Drug Mart has been selling what we now know is worthless homeopathic products, including oscillium, which is the supposed duck liver that cures the flu somehow. And anyway, this lawsuit has been named after repeated calls to Shoppers Drug Mart to stop selling these products, that they're medically worthless, that they're inactive ingredients, that sort of thing. And of course, Shoppers Drug Mart ignored those requests and has now forced the legal intervention of skeptical organizations like CFI. So I encourage you to tune in next week on Radio for Thinker when we talk more about this lawsuit in depth. And perhaps we'll get some more information for you on what is going to happen next and what Shoppers Drug Mart's response will be to this lawsuit.
That sounds so exciting, Ethan. I cannot wait to show up to next week's show. My skeptic highlights, and I've got two this week. One sort of relates to something we talked about last week. CBC's Legacy, Past, Present, and Future. It's happening April 19th at 7 to 10 p.m. at the Vogue Theater. Adrian Knight and members of Zolas and Bastronauts will be featured in an event that showcases the past, present, and future legacy of the CBC and celebrates community-driven ideas that reimagine the CBC as a public media outlet. So it sounds interesting just to show your support for the CBC and to see what really have we been missing from the emaciated version of the CBC we currently have. Another one, this is something just released by the American Library Association, and we'll have a link on this on our website, has released the Top Banned Books of 2011. Apparently, it's based upon a bunch of challenges that they received to the official Office of Intellectual Freedoms of people who are complaining about particular books. So these aren't exactly banned, but these are sort of the books that are considered to be the most offensive based upon reports and challenges to the people who keep charge of that. Number one on the list, and I won't go through them all, but number one I think is worth mentioning. So it was listed, it's by Lauren Miracle. It's apparently has offensive language, religious viewpoints, sexually explicit, and unsuitable to various age groups. Now the title of it is TTYL, TTFN, L8R, G8R. Apparently it's a series. Of course, for people who are literate in the web world, that's, of course, Talk to You Later, Ta-Ta for Now, Later, and Gator, which, of course, just tells you the horrible state of the English language, or at least the evolving state of the English language. But check that out. Find out what people have been bitching about and what's the latest books that may show up on some bonfire sometime soon. So this is Don saying eyes open, minds on.
And this is Ethan, your free-thinking historian, saying thanks for listening. See you next week.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.
Venture to the stars. A still more glorious dawn awaits, not a sunrise, but a galaxy rise.